welcome to Offensive Shadows.
Your 15 minutes with a broad, her bud, and the bard.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Danny.
And we're welcoming you to Two Gentlemen of Verona, Shakespeare's first comedy. Or was it his first comedy?
Well, the only text we have from Shakespeare's era is the first folio of 1623. There's a theory that the play was composed in two phases, part written in 1592 and then part added for performance late in 1593, but it may have been written as early as 1590 or 1591. It's difficult to date. The first mention is in Mears' list of 1598, but because of some romantic elements included in the play, people argue that it happens later in the chronology.
What romantic elements?
Oh, heroines disguising themselves as boys, people going into the woods to do crazy things, people taking journeys away from their hometown. These are elements that appear later in Shakespeare's plays, like As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Comedy of Errors, and Taming of the Shrew. But they're also elements of earlier English comedy, so Shakespeare could have just been doing his reading.
So he may have just been drawing on the material of the day. So what makes people think it's one of his earlier plays then?
Well, stylistically, it relies heavily on soliloquy, dialogue, and asides to comment. 13 of the play's 20 scenes are realized entirely of these three elements. Shakespeare attempts to make complex orchestrations of voices, but whenever he manages it in this play, it's stilted, awkward, and ill-sustained. Characters are often left just standing around to be forgotten about, and the dialogue, whenever anything needs to be moved forward, shifts into two-person tête-à-têtes. And neither Comedy of Errors nor Taming of the Shrew, the two comedies that are written definitely about this time as well, are limited in that way, and both use three or more characters rather easily. And because of this, it's very possible that Two Gentlemen of Verona was Shakespeare's first professional play.
I would definitely agree that it's one of his more simplistic plays, therefore probably one of his earlier plays. It's kind of like Titus in that it's a very, very tight, straightforward plot line where you focus just on the two men and the two women. There isn't much in the way of separate large side plots.
Yeah, we do have the one side plot with Thurio, but even that wraps back into the Sylvia Valentine plot. And then there's the one sort of side plot with Launce and his dog Crab, but that's all shared in soliloquy, and it's not really anything that has any bearing on the story.
And is that the part that they theorize was added later?
Yeah, they do theorize that that Launce and the dog were added later to appeal to audiences of the day. Animals were very popular on the Elizabethan stage. And as I mentioned in one of the Titus episodes, they would always have like real animals on stage, like they had bears.
The bear thing still astounds me.
We'll get there when we get to Winter's Tale. So what did you think about the play?
So overall, I like the play. I generally like a good tight storyline, a good fast-moving storyline. And this play doesn't meander much at all. It's pretty focused. However, I like the play right up until the end. And I have some real problems with the end. And I think this is mostly because it's like we said, it's one of Shakespeare's earlier plays. And he shoehorns in a happy ending for a number of characters, at least one of which doesn't deserve his happy ending at all. We see in Shakespeare's later plays, he will have a bittersweet happy ending for his comedy, where if somebody doesn't deserve their happy ending, they're not going to get it.
It's true. It does seem like a very sort of amateur move to make sure that everybody has a happy ending. But I mean, we'll talk about the complications innate therein probably in the next episode. You really don't like Proteus, do you?
No, I don't like Proteus. At least I like him as the antagonist of the play. The problem is he is also the goal of Julia, who's someone you want to root for, someone you want to have a happy ending. But at least as far as I see, and as I'm sure a modern audience will see, her happy ending should not be Proteus, and that's what she gets in the end.
Julia's really the first in a long line of Shakespearean women whose men don't deserve them. I would argue that with the exception of Beatrice and Benedick and Tamara and Aaron, most couples in Shakespeare are completely mismatched.
As certainly the case here, although I would say that Valentine and Sylvia definitely deserve each other because they are both the classy, upfront, upstanding, heroic characters in each in their own way in this play. They definitely deserve to be happy together. I just think that Julia deserves a much better man than what she got in the end.
And the integrity of these characters is really interesting. As you said, Sylvia just stays classy. She's just wonderful. And the women, even though there's a conflict over men, it doesn't drive them apart. Even though they're in direct opposition, they're still very nice to each other. And even when there's no one on stage to listen to them, they say nice things about each other.
That actually I found very surprising. It was an interesting aspect of the play, was how the two women who were competing or somewhat at odds in a romantic aspect for the men that are pursuing them, still manage to have a strong relationship between the two of them.
And it's interesting, too, because Valentine was one of the things that Shakespeare added to the story. The story is something he stole. He could have gotten it from a couple of different sources. There's a Portuguese story called Diana by this writer, Jorge de Montemayor. Sorry, it's in Diana. It's called Felix and Felismina. And it would have been available in a French translation to Shakespeare. He might also have been working off of a lost play called The History of Felix and Philomena, performed by the Queen's men in court in 1585. In neither of these stories is there a Valentine character, and in both of them, as far as we can tell, the Sylvia equivalent is conveniently killed off at the end, leaving Proteus and Julia to have a happy ending.
Which is really kind of sad, considering the fact that if I was going to pick one of those three characters to kill off, it would not have been Sylvia. And surprise, surprise, it would not have been Julia.
Well, I mean, you need to give the worthy heroine her happy ending. What else does she have if she doesn't have a man in these days, right? Am I right?
You're right. I think it's important to point out that when we researched this play, we watched the 1983 BBC version of the play. BBC did a number. Actually, I believe they did all of
Shakespeare. They did a series of all of them, yeah.
It's a pretty faithful adaptation of the text. Didn't cut anything that I'm aware of. And it's a very, very well done production. It's very watchable. It's done in a style that makes it feel like you're watching theater, as the sets are not minimalistic, but very stylistic of a stage, as opposed to attempting to do full-on sets for a more elaborate production.
And that's pretty consistent with that BBC series. It makes you feel like you're watching theater without giving you that awkward, I'm watching somebody who video to community theater production feeling.
Act one is a standard opening act where it introduces us to the two gentlemen, Proteus being the love-struck boy and Valentine being depicted as the go-getter. Proteus is in Verona attempting to woo the lovely Julia, and Valentine spends most of the act saying goodbye to his friend, because he is off to become a more worldly gentleman and traveling to Milan.
Fun fact, the first act of this play is actually being performed in the Globe during Shakespeare in Love. During one of the scenes, they come in and there's a performance going on, and you can hear the actors very clearly say, "Cease to persuade my loving Proteus," which is the first line of this show.
So what was your favorite, part of Act One?
I love the letter scene. The letter speech was the first speech ever given to me by a very influential man in my life, Mr. John Basil, who wrote the book Willpower, by the way. And there's just something so compelling about two women tormenting each other on stage. I mean, we'll see it again with the nurse and Juliet. We'll see it again with Celia and Rosalind. And this is just where it starts.
It is definitely a good scene. It's an important scene for a couple of reasons, too, because it's one of the few instances where Julie gets to actually be a woman, or in this case, a girl, before she delves into cross-dressing and to playing the part of a man. It's also the first instance that we have in the play where we have a letter that doesn't necessarily reach its intended recipient intact.
Let me tackle those two things in the order which you presented them. The first, you kind of make it sound like she's delving into the seedy underbelly of heroin-soaked Milan. But it's true. In every show where we have a woman dressing as a man, and remember in Shakespeare's time, it was boy actors playing women playing men. So you had that double layer of craziness going on. You have at least one scene, and in the case of Viola in Twelfth Night, it actually is just one scene where they have to establish themselves as women before they become men. And this is important because we see the genuine character of this character. It's the beginning of the character arc. And it's also where we see what they need to learn, right? Because whenever you go into the woods, you learn something. So what is it that they're, how is it that they're going to change? What is it that they're going to be when they come out? What are they coming back to? And how is their disguise going to change them? And the letter, as far as that's concerned, letters in this play are never delivered to their intended recipient and almost never read. So the letter for Julia was delivered to Lucetta while Lucetta pretended to be Julia. And then Julia rips it up before she even gets a chance to read it. So it's always been interesting to me what Shakespeare was saying about the transience of the written word, and especially love letters. Like, this is the greatest love poet of the English language, and I'll say it, of all time. And he's tearing up love letters on stage before their recipients can read them. How about you? What was your favorite part of Act One?
It has to be speed and the mutton scene. After we have the Julia and Lucetta scene, we get to see the love-struck Proteus waiting not so patiently to find out the results of, I think we're going to assume, his first attempt at opening courtship with Julia. No,
he's been doing this for a while. He's just not very good at it.
So at his latest attempt at attempting to court Julia, and he had asked the servant of his friend Valentine, boy Speed, to deliver his love letter to Julia. And Speed has returned and isn't giving Proteus anything. Proteus is demanding to find out what happened. He wants to know what kind of response he got from Julia. And Speed, being the clown, taunts and mocks Proteus with a pretty well-written sequence of quips and taunts until finally he relents and tells him that he delivered the letter to Julia, but he doesn't have a response. What's ironic, as you said, he didn't actually deliver the letter to Julia. He gave it to Lucetta.
I think it's also funny that you find the scene when the men are tormenting each other to be the most compelling part of the act, and I find the scene where the women are tormenting each other to be the most compelling part of the act.
You can't go wrong with Speed, though.
No, Speed's a pretty well-written character. He's Shakespeare's first quick-witted fool, and whenever you see him performed, you're going to see like this small little Cupid-like, Mercury-like guy, and the BBC version of it is actually a kid. And he talks fast, and he moves fast, and he's always bing, 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 bing.
And the BBC version, actually, they cast an excellent, excellent child actor in the role. He had a really strong command of the language. It was impressive.
Yeah, he was pretty good. But Speed also brings to mind another important part of this play, namely that the characters all have names that sound like what they are. So Speed, he's fast, he's the quick-witted fool. Then you have Valentine, the true lover, obviously named after Saint Valentine. Then you have Proteus, whose name means the changed one or changed. You've got Julia, who's the jewel, she's the prize. He'll use that again in Juliet. Julietta, Julia, he likes the name Julia. And then you have Sylvia, who's the silver. She's also this precious thing to be won.
So eventually, by the end of Act One, Proteus does get his response from Julia. She's reassembled the letter and delivered a response, a positive response, to Proteus.
Sweet love, sweet lines, sweet life. It's so ridiculous.
Unfortunately for Proteus, he is caught by his father when he's reading this love letter from Julia. And he is too ashamed to tell his father what the letter actually is when his father asks him what he's reading. He instead lies and says it is a letter from his friend Valentine, who is in Milan. His father responds with, "How fortunate, because I'm sending you to Milan also." He thinks it's a great idea that his son should become a worldly gentleman like Valentine. And Proteus is now stuck. He has just praised the actions of his friend Valentine out in Milan, And when his father tells him he's going to do the same thing, he has no grounds to stand on and doesn't have the courage to say, no, wait, I'm in love with a woman here and I want to stay. Instead, he takes the coward's route and lies and allows himself to be shipped off to Milan away from Julia. This is his first display of how he is not worthy of Julia, because when it came time for him to show a little courage and to stand up for her, he buckles under to his father.
And then whines to the audience about how sad he is.
And then we see Julia standing up and saying, my love is going to Milan. I'm going to follow him. And that's the end of Act 1. We will pick up next week with Act 2, and we will close the show out with the mutton scene.
Sir Protheus, save you. Saw you, my master. But now he parted, hence to embark for Milan.
20-1, then. He is shipped already.
And I have played the sheep in losing him.
Indeed, a sheep doth very often stray. And if the shepherd be a while away...
You conclude that my master is a shepherd, then, and I a sheep?
I do.
Why? Then my horns are his horns, whether I wake or sleep.
A silly answer, and fitting well, a sheep.
This proves me still a sheep.
True, and thy master a shepherd.
Nay, that I can deny by a circumstance.
Shall go hard, but I'll prove it by another.
The shepherd seeks the sheep, and not the sheep the shepherd. But I seek my master, and my master seeks not me. Therefore, I am no sheep.
The sheep, for fodder, follow the shepherd. The shepherd, for food, follows not the sheep. Thou, for wages, followest thy master. Thy master, for wages, followest not thee. Therefore, thou art a sheep.
Such another proof will make me cry, bah!
But dost thou hear? Goest thou my letter to Julia?
Aye, sir. I, a lost mutton, gave your letter to her, a laced mutton. And she, a laced mutton, gave me, a lost mutton, nothing for my labor.
Here's too small a pasture for such store of muttons.
If the ground be overcharged, you were best stick her.
But what said she?
I.
Nod I? Why, that's naughty.
You mistook, sir. I said she did nod. And if you ask me, she did nod, and I say I.
And that set together is naughty.
Now you have taken the pains to set it together. Take it for your pains.
No, you shall have it for bearing the letter.
Well, I perceive I must be fain to bear with you.
Why, sir, how do you bear with me?
Marry, sir, the letter very orderly, having nothing but the word naughty for my pain.
Beshrew me, but you have a quick wit.
And yet it cannot overtake your slow purse.
Come, open the matter in brief. What said she?
Open your purse, that the money and the matter may be both at once delivered.
Well, sir, here is for your pains. What said she?
Truly, sir? I think you'll hardly win her.
Why? Couldst thou perceive so much from her?
Sir, I could perceive nothing at all from her. No, not so much as a ducat for delivering your letter, and being so hard to me that brought your mind, I fear she'll prove as hard to you in telling your mind. Give her no token but stones, for she's as hard as steel.
What said she? Nothing?
No, not so much as take this for thy pains. Testify your bounty. I thank you. You have sestered me in requital whereof, henceforth, carry your letters yourself. And so, sir, I'll commend you to my master.
Go, be gone, to save your ship from wrack, which cannot perish having thee aboard, being destined to a drier death on shore. I must go send some better messenger. I fear my Julia would not deign my lines, receiving them from such a worthless post.
Offensive Shadows would like to thank Mr. Matthew Rosevalley for the wonderful music, Mr. Christopher Knowles for his graphic art expertise, and the vocal stylings of Mr. Gavin Fishman and Angelo Calderon.
And we will leave you with live you with. That's great.